Marion Stewart is my guest this week. Marion was at Lampeter in the 1980s, where she studied divinity. She talks about the oddity of being in the same peer group as her lecturers. She reflects on how she took a subject that her parents wouldn't really have approved of. She remembers the legendary D.P. Davis. From childhood, Marion recalls the bombs that dropped during the Second World War. She remembers when the grounds of Crystal Palace opened up. She talks about being teacher's favourite. She had to deal with bullying. She talks about the rules of grammar school, how different it is from today. She talks about the difference between public and private school, her experience of working in a Lebanese refugee school in Cyprus. She talks about the school choir, learning songs from musicals, the concept of pop music being of the devil. She talks about being a reader in the church in Wales, about being a member of the movement for the ordination of women, why Marion was an agony aunt to some of the younger students. She talks about working in Pooh's Corner, how the mural of Winnie the Pooh was created by her own daughter. We talk about the role that university plays in learning about yourself, why Lampeter is the kind of place that you could just stay there forever. Marion in turn asks me what it feels like now to live in Canterbury. We talk about fate and destiny, political influences, how she once crossed the political floor, why students latch on to particular parties. We talk about Brexit, and this is a bit embarrassing now because we had this conversation in November 2019. We talk about whether Brexit will ever happen, why she was a supporter of Wales becoming independent, why she hates strikes. We learn whether her memories are positive. She links this to questions of spirituality and turning around negative things. She talks about officiating at weddings in Cyprus and carrying out humanist funerals. We find out how she ended up in Cyprus, how different it is in an age when she has so many Facebook friends to grow up in a house without a telephone, and why Marion thinks that life is a gift which has to be used. An immense privilege to catch up in November 2019 with Marion Stewart for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a delight for the second time to meet Marion Stewart. And you've come, I like to think you came all the way from Cyprus to do this interview. And of course, we have a very strong Lampeter connection.
We do.
And you know, you were at Lampeter in the late 80s, is that right?
Yeah, my connection with Lampeter was from 83 through to 90, when I threw away an MA, but I graduated in 88. I think you came, was it 91?
Yeah, so I was there as an undergraduate in 91. Okay. So you probably crossed, yeah, I think lots of people, we have many mutual friends.
We do.
But as inevitable, it's like that game, is it 3 degrees of Kevin Bacon? Everybody knows somebody who knows somebody.
That's right.
But you don't always get to meet. But
I still owned my house when I ran away to teach in South Cyprus.
Tell me a bit then, Marion, about your background, well, not least how you got to Lampeter, because you went there as a mature student, didn't you?
I know the right student. I was part of the Mature Students Association. And I was of an age where all the lecturers were my peer group, so I really was an oddity. Yeah. And my daughter was then at College at Carmarthen, and so she knew all my fellow students as her mates as well.
Yeah. Yeah, and now you did. I did theology. I think you were a divinity student.
Divinity. Dare to be different. I didn't want to do straight theology.
And the reason that I was put off from doing that was because I didn't want to learn Greek and Hebrew. But I'm guessing that you probably excelled in those languages.
Yeah, apparently I did. I walked in and saw the wonderful DP, and said, I want to do a university degree. My parents would never let me, and it's time to catch up. And because I was very involved in the church, I thought that theology, no, divinity is a bit too much. Why don't you combine it, theology with Welsh studies? Because I was learning Welsh. And I said, I wanted to do divinity. So we agreed that I would sit in. I'd already done modern Greek, so that wasn't a problem. So he agreed that I could sit in on the Hebrew class for a year, and if I was okay with that, as I was also doing Welsh O-level, he let me do it. And I did, I was top of the class in Hebrew. So.
And so you stayed in Lampeter for a number of years.
Yeah, but I already had a house there. I moved there in 83.
But in terms of getting there in the first place, because
you spent a lot of time around this part of the world. We're meeting in a pub in Canterbury.
Yeah, I was born in South London, and I spent my early years. When did I move out? Trying to remember. From Battersea, I moved out to Kent. I moved to Kent in 1976 to a place called Cuddon, which is across from Biggin Hill Airport. And I don't know why, I felt wanted something more rural. We looked at Devon and Cornwall, and I suppose it was divine providence or somebody else that I ended up in Mid Wales.
Yeah. And what about memories from childhood growing up in South London? What are your earliest memories? What can you remember from childhood?
Bombs dropping. I was in London through the whole of the World War.
So you were born just around the beginning of the Second World War?
Yeah, I think I caused it. Yeah. I was born and then the war started. And my parents wouldn't have me evacuated because they said, one dies, we all die. You know, they weren't going to have me left as an orphan.
Yeah.
So to me, it was just one big game. I can remember going out in the street one day and saying, oh, look, 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 look. It was a doodle bug going over. My mum said, you can't stand out there.
No, but I was interviewing somebody else who was born in the mid-1930s and remembers the start of the war and remembers being evacuated. But of course her memories are meeting these wonderful new friends and playing and being evacuated to the seaside, where she ended up staying for the rest, you know, she's still living there now in Pembrokeshire.
Wow.
So it just goes, so I'm guessing that although the war was going on around and nobody quite knew what the future had in store, as children I'm guessing there were opportunities to be a little bit more adventurous.
Absolutely free. I mean, I started school at the age of four, which was unusual, because most of the children had evacuated. So we were completely, we didn't have rules and regulations. You can't have rules and regulations in wartime. And one of the other things I remember, which was a great freedom after the war, was when Crystal Palace grounds opened up. And of course we were free to go anywhere. We went inside those dinosaur statue things and climbing through the old maze. It was a wonderful freedom, and I think it's a shame that kids today are faced with so many rules and regulations. And I'm sure that's why I'm healthy, eating dirt and surviving.
Because what about things like schooling? I'm guessing during the war, I mean, compared to today when, you know, if you miss a day's school, there are all sorts of sanctions or...
Oh, that's
you know,
right. No. It's, I don't remember, apart from being ill, my first year at school, I think I got every childhood disease going, which built up my immune system, for which I'm grateful.
Yeah, so actually you can look back now and you've got everything now.
That's
so
right. Yeah,
there's nothing left to contract.
No. And I remember that there were a lot of us in a classroom downstairs in the school, so that it was almost like an air raid shelter in itself.
Yeah.
So apart from being absent due to illness, I love school.
Yeah.
And I was teacher's favourite, which kind of makes you, brings the bullies out, but I was quite...
So, and what were the other pupils in the class? What did they make of that then? Because being teacher's favourite is great between you and the pupils.
Well, there was
the
one
teacher.
Bully that my dad had to deal with. Just the one. And I was a very little tubby child, so I had the mickey taken out of me for my size and my pigtails. All the girls had pigtails.
Did you find that a lot of those experiences still... Do you still think back to those sort of...
No, I've dealt with
them. I do. Sense sometimes you walk into environments and you think, gosh, I remember being like this when I was 14 or something
that.
You know, fear almost of dealing with somebody who's a bully.
Yes. I don't like confrontations anyway, at any time. I'm a bit of a coward. I'm fine, like you, when you're up front and you've got people hanging on your every word and you're there to help them, to serve them. But when you're confronted in a more difficult situation where you're not in charge, I walk away.
It's funny because when I was at school, I didn't ever think, until maybe GCSE or A-levels, that we were there really to be educated. It felt like we were there to conform. It was about making sure that you walked on the right side or there would be punishments. You know, when you
grammar school was full of rules. Yes, when I was one of the clever kids that passed the 11 class and went to grammar school. And it's quite amazing that my bank manager in Cyprus went to the same school generations later, but it's no longer a grammar school. But there were strict rules. That was good for us. today's children don't have that discipline and containment that brings out, I think it brings out the best in the end.
Yeah, and I always say to my students, particularly those who perhaps don't attend as many classes as we would like
to
do,
I always say,
well, in 10 or 20 years time, you're not going to look back and say, I wish I'd gone to fewer classes. Mm. But you might say, I wish I'd gone to a few more. So in that sense, I do think that even if at the time it's not cool, sometimes to go to, because you know, you don't choose to go to school, you have to go there.
I found that the difference is between public and private schools. My first teaching job in Cyprus was in a Lebanese school, you know, Lebanese refugees. And it was a school, Melkart school, that had come over. And some of those surly teenage boys, you know, and of course you can use the, well, your parent has paid for you to be here and you should honour what they're doing for you. But you can't say that to some snotty-nosed kid in a state school. It doesn't work.
No. Although I was watching a Ken Loach movie last night at the cinema, and of course that told things from a very different perspective. And that was about, you know, aspiration in an environment where there's a lack of opportunity. So school is almost sort of seen to be a bit of an irrelevance. But what about, you mentioned your time in school, what about favourite subjects? What was the, you mentioned that you were the top in your class, but what was the class that you were in?
I think, funnily enough, probably English, because whenever the teacher had to leave the room, I had to read, you know, age 5, 6, 7, I had to read. And I love drama and I loved art. I'm that way inclined, which is probably why languages are reasonably easy. I'm not a scientist. All I learnt was H2SO4, you don't drink, because you do drink H2O, but that's the extent
of my science. And I was even told, I don't know, it was the chemistry teacher who taught us this, so poor old John is with us no more, for what he thought was H2O, was H2SO4.
Really, I've not heard that one.
I think that may have got my, you know, my grade C in chemistry GCSE is down to that.
Well, I went off science when I sat one day looking out the window, and she said, Blake, well, that was my maiden name. Yeah. Stop sitting there like a suet pudding. And I thought, I don't like you.
But it is, but the school experience, I think it was much later on that I thought, I'm, you know, you don't have a passion for subjects, and you then, irrespective of whether you have a good teacher or a bad teacher, or whether you've got homework or not, you want to push yourself forward.
Yeah,
and that's when you know that when, because at the end of the day, yes, the teacher can spoon feed, and yes, you can copy what you're given in class. And some students go to university and they'll say, oh, but I did this at A level and I know all the answers because my teacher told me. But it's a different beast after that.
I think one of the things that I used to say to people at my mature age was, go into university, taught me more questions and less answers.
And tell me about, in terms of childhood, musical influences, because just as we were starting to record, we heard the tail end of Kiki D and Elton John, and I thought, I was only three in 1976, but for me that's, you know, in terms of nostalgic numbers, you know, that sort of like would appear very much to the top of my list. But what do you remember listening to when you were growing up? Were the charts sort of influential in growing up?
Poor little me, no radio at home. No television in those days, so all my music was the school choir. And of course there was no pop music, it was always classical pieces. And I didn't realise I liked classical music until one day in school, I was about 11, and I was humming a tune. And my music teacher heard me, and she said, oh, that's Rachmaninoff's 18th variation on the theme of Paganini. I said, no, miss, it's the story of three loves, because I'd seen the movie, but I loved the music. But equally, my father was tone deaf, and my mother used to think that anybody liked opera was weird. But I belonged to quite a lot of choirs, and I did a lot of classics, and I started on singing lessons when I was 17. So that also is the classical stuff. Although I learned lots of songs from shows. Now, I like songs from shows like My Fair Lady, West Side Story, South Pacific, Kiss Me Kate, all those old musicals. Although I must admit that there are one or two pieces that I like from Les Miserables and so on, but I'm afraid pop music just leaves me stone cold. And I always remember one of my strict Baptist friends And there's a guy in Cyprus who's also a strict Baptist that that music is of the devil. You don't listen to it. And another thing I remember, when they first brought out discos, the flashing lights and the music, there was a huge article in the Telegraph newspaper saying how it affects the brain, the flashing lights and the loud music. And of course, at the time of it, really. But the more one studies, the more one realizes that these are very positive influences on the brains of maturing youngsters.
No, and I think the power of recall sometimes, that it might be a trivial pop song, but if you're writing an essay, or if there's something that you're working on, your homework, and that's on, then sometimes that can help you recall particular dates or stories or plot lines.
Yeah.
And I found that many years later, that I'd be able to associate particular songs from, you know, maybe from 30, 40 or more years ago with something that was, you know, and even if it was an old song, like My Old Man's a Dustman,
what's his name, Lonnie Donegan.
And my dad was hugely into Lonnie Donegan when he was young, because I inherited that. But of course, for me, I can easily demarcate my nursery years, because that was always
I didn't have any of those. Sunday school choruses, by the bucketful, hymns by the bucketful. And of course, when I moved to Wales, I was right in the middle of it, all the wonderful Command Vaganis and the Eisteddfod Fodai and so on, my kind of music.
And what about performing music, though? Because did you play any instruments?
No, I always, as a child, wanted to learn piano, but my parents hadn't got any money and they wouldn't even let me have a piano, let alone have lessons. I did start to learn in the 70s when my daughter was learning, but I let it slide. So all my musical money invested was to do with singing, which, I did quite a bit. I sang in the chapel at Christmas carols. Asked a couple of the students from my vintage what they thought about it.
What were you doing, a solo?
Yeah, I did a couple.
What
were
you doing? Once you rolled David City or Away in the Manger?
No. Oh Holy Night, which I like, and what's the other one? I still do them when I give them a chance. Can't remember, but there's two favourites. But I've also done things like How Beautiful Are the Feet of Them from the Messiah, and I remember in my Baptist church I did the mezzo bits.
So going to the chapel, how did you end up studying divinity? Why did you choose that subject? Was there
I became a reader in the Church of Wales before I went to university, so that sort of tidied it all, and it made me more acceptable round the churches, you know. Oh, she goes to Lampeter, you know. So that, you know, as a Saesneg, that made me a little more acceptable. And I was actually first attached to the rural dean at Trehearn, the Reverend Eric Williams, who was quite a character. And then I had that transferred to the college chapel, so I was reader at the chapel with Christine Bonniewell, was the chaplain then. And there was another guy, Steve Ambani, who was getting a degree by faith. We all went round trying to get him grant money, but dear old George Noakes, who became Archbishop of Wales, he was a wonderful help and support to people.
And have you maintained links with many of those same
individuals? Yeah, I have. Well, a dear old George came over to Cyprus at one stage, but of course he's now been promoted. I'm still in touch with Steve Ambani. He lives just outside of Cardiff. But I'm also in touch with, in my time, there was Timothy Hewitt, who went into the church, Hugh Lurvey, who's in the church, Kath Trimble. They all got priested. They wouldn't priest me because I was too old, too ugly, and female.
Well, that, I'm thinking, though, that would have been just before the ordination. But
I was studying
with Paul Badham.
Of course, on the day of
the ordination, well, this was of the a priest in 1992, November 92.
Yeah.
And it was very exciting because we were studying that as part of our module. So it was that sense almost that switching on the news was actually going to help us with our essays.
That felt,
and we also had John Hick in that period who came to give a talk on religious pluralism. So we kind of felt that what we were studying in the classroom was very there was lots going on outside.
Well, I was a member of the Movement for the Ordination of Women from way back when I was a pastoral assistant in Rochester Diocese. So I felt that that was a very important move forward. Yeah. And I went to Chester Cathedral to the first service for the ordination of women, because I had a couple of female friends that were deaconed, so this was their day of great rejoicing when they were priested. Paul Baddon could never actually find what Paul was thinking.
Were there some particular individuals? I know that obviously D.P. Davis, who sadly passed away only a month or so ago, had a huge impact. But what do you remember from the staff in what was a very small department, but a very
welcoming
department?
Peter Morris, who was absolutely lovely, and he did Old Testament Hebrew. I did the Dead Sea Scrolls with him. That was a very small group. There was only five of us. That was wonderful. Paul Baddon, of course, who at that stage was desperate to get to America, and his wife, of course, who was absolutely brilliant. Marvellous brain, fantastic. And, of course, his little son was very little in those days. Peter, sadly, got Alzheimer's, and that upset DP a lot. I remember DP going to Peter's funeral, and it was a typical bad day in Wales of snow and impassable roads. I remember others from the other departments, but the main one, what was his name, the lovely old boy, Blyving.
Know him, but the name
He retired after I'd been there a short while. He was lovely. And then, of course, Mr. Price, who I used to help with communion, because he also looked after Bethel's Bloodworth up the road. So, again, because of my age and status in life, by that stage I think I was a grandmother to my stepdaughter, it was odd, it's a bit like when I was teacher's pet at school when little. There am I, this woman who's a student but the same age as the tutors, and of course related to them in terms of life experience. So I was a bit of an oddity. Also, Steve Ambani christened me as the numinous one. Now, only theology students will know what that's all about. One of the first books that we had to study about gore and so on. Because under my cassock, I used to wear coloured tights. So every time that Steve went to take the challenge, what coloured tights has she got on this week?
You were distracting all the males.
It wasn't my fault. I was just don't look at my feet.
In terms of some of the younger students, I get the sense you got on really quite well with them. You had some good friendships.
Yes. Gareth, who's also priested, and he married a girl at uni. They're since divorced. And he's now teaching at a school. I bet he wrote fairly recently on Facebook about, you know, Auntie Marion. And I was also part of the Christian organisation. So, and because I was attached to chapel, I was also a bit like an auntie and an agony aunt and so on.
And were you comfortably on first name terms with the staff? I only ask that because I felt very awkward.
My students now don't, because of my age.
Because they all call me Chris, and I'm very comfortable with that.
Well, times have changed.
But I couldn't have called Paul Baddon Paul or D.P. Davis D.P. Or D.P. Because he went by that name.
Yes.
But I didn't want that sort of familiarity. It seemed wrong when you come from a school system where everybody was so amiss.
I can't remember, but it could well be that when I was down in the kitchen in... what was the name of it?
Brindulas,
that's right, yeah. I often used to sit in there and have a cup of tea or coffee with the staff. I would then talk by their Christian name. But I think if we were in a lecture room, I wouldn't do that. You know, horses for courses.
Of course, some students get around this by just calling everybody professor. And, and certainly, that can actually be worse, but somebody says, I have not attained that rank.
Yeah. Well, yes, when I started teaching in Cyprus, the Turks all come up with hoca, and, what? But they don't bother to know names or remember names.
Did you have any particular memories, aside from the academic study, but any particular memories from being a student, maybe arts hall films you might have gone to, or you mentioned chapel, but any particular experiences of meeting students?
I met them all over the place, and of course Pooh's Corner was in operation, and I used to work in there as well, and my daughter did the mural of Winnie the Pooh when she was still at school. She went to school at Aberaeron. This was before she went to art college. So what with the organisations I belonged to, Pooh's Corner, and when I was doing my master's, I also worked evenings in the library. I was constantly in touch with students, and I constantly forgot that we were at the same age.
Yeah.
We're students together.
Yeah, and certainly Pooh's Corner was for anybody listening who doesn't know Lampeter, that was a eating establishment within the student union, with a Pooh's Corner, very popular, a mural on the wall. But there are many photographs which I happened to, I think that's how we got in touch, because I posted a picture of me playing pool.
Right, the pool.
They had a pool room, they weren't serving food in August, so we had a pool table in there. And there's a photograph of me with the mural in the background, and you said it was your daughter who painted that.
Did the mural. Another person I'm still in touch with is Keith Reagan, who was running Pooh's Corner at the time. He lived outside of Lampeter, and he's now living down in Zomerzat.
Yeah.
And we're still in touch occasionally. When I'm over, I go and see him.
Yeah.
He's now well retired.
Yeah.
There's another Ruth Weston, or Ruth, I can't remember her original surname, married David Weston, another fellow student. And it's all, please come and see us.
Yeah.
I can't get to Wales this trip. So we're all in touch on Facebook, which is rather lovely. And that's why I... sounds terrible. In Cyprus, there's lots of
pensioners, dear, from UK.
And I look at them and I think, you're all so old. Because I still relate to all these students who are now at the stage I was when I got my degree.
No, and indeed, I was 18 when I went to Lampeter. My mother was 46. I'm now 46.
Okay.
At the age of 18, 46 seemed old.
Yeah,
of course, now I feel terribly young, of course, although I did say to my students, but I also asked them not to respond, do you consider me to be old?
And
they were very, very wise and wouldn't answer that one.
No.
But it's this whole sense of perspective that you never lose your sense of, there's almost like a basic kernel. We are a certain type of person, and we may evolve in character. We have our peaks and we have our troughs. But there is that sense that the friends that you cultivate, the friendships you cultivate when you're 18, you can still, there's no reason, maybe different at primary school, because you really go off in very different areas when you're five.
Yes, I'm only in touch with one. And you, geographically you move, but there is something, I remember somebody saying that university isn't just for learning, it's for education, to learn about yourself and life and grow up.
But it sounds like, because you mentioned the agony aunt, I don't know, I'm putting that word in your mouth, but it feels as though with some of the younger students as well, that you were very much a mother figure for them.
Yeah, I was, yes, because there wasn't anybody else of my vintage at all. And because I'd got children the same age as the students, that was another putting me into their zone, if you like. And I understood them well because I was trying to understand my own daughter.
And did you find as well that, because looking back, I do find that from such a small place as Lampeter, I stuck it out for 10 years and loved it. But the first thing people say to me, who I've known for many years and have just gone there, knowing that I went there all those years ago and gone for a conference for a weekend, happened in the summer, and they say, it's a lovely place, but how did you stick at it for 10 years? What's the answer to that, Mary?
Well, I, of course, had a house there. I moved there because I wanted to be there. And I'd go back tomorrow if I could afford it. I hate the weather. But I do remember at Freshers Fairs, girls in tears, and 3 days later you hear they just couldn't hack the cut-off thing of Wales. But I, of course, had come from a rural area to go to Wales, and I was established in myself, which is quite different to the challenges. But equally, some of those that were there when I started became eternal students, because they just loved Lampeter and they just carried on studying.
And it's like a race, I suppose, because if you're running a marathon, you could run it as a 100-metre race, and you might get through the first half a mile, but then you're going to wear yourself out, and you're never going to finish the other 26 miles.
No.
But if you pace yourself, then you can hit the finishing line. And I think that may be what happened in my case, that I went somewhere where the pace was very different to perhaps what I, or what my contemporaries were used to, many of them
from Cardiff.
And I do think, therefore, that somehow I managed to make sure that I sort of, you know, it's like with many things in life, if you know what your limitations are.
Yeah, but also you're a man of Wales, aren't you? Which is quite different for some of the students who've come right the other side of England.
I had well, that's the irony of now living in Canterbury, because
I knew
so many people from this part of the world when I was in Lampeter, and now I'm living in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And in some cases, do occasionally meet up with some of those people. Some of them obviously are living in very different places.
How do you feel living in Canterbury as opposed to Lampeter and Cardiff?
I think it was a necessary move for me to make, because I'd been in Wales my whole life until my early 30s, and of course I only really had one point of comparison. And if you've only worked in one place, I mean, like you, I worked in the library, but otherwise just had an academic job in the University of Wales. So and I spent 3 years at Carmarthen as well, but when I moved in Trinity from about 2001 to 2004, so when I moved to Canterbury, I think I was ready for that move. But I know that at the age of 18, I think I would have been very intimidated by a place like this. I mean, in a way that, you know, seems almost laughable now, because I have students who sometimes, some of them say, oh, it's Canterbury's too big, some will say Canterbury's too small, because it depends what you're used to. But I teach students now who are from Carmarthen and from Pembrokeshire. So I feel very Welsh, of course, when I'm in their company, because I don't sound Welsh when I'm in Wales, but I feel that I can get away with it in Canterbury.
Yeah.
But is that your sense as well, though, that, you know, it's a different sort of environment, that somehow it's like, a good example, I suppose, would be a student who once told me that he went to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And he was underwhelmed by the experience. The best part of the day was sitting in a coffee shop or going to the pub with friends, because it was such a big event, and there was the weather was terrible, and the bus was rickety, and everybody was pushing and shoving. And you just thought, I want peace and quiet. Lampeter is the sort of place that would give you that peace.
Yes, it's almost too peaceful. But don't you think? I think if one believes in any kind of fate or destiny, if you're in the right place, then you slot everything else into that.
Yeah.
But if you're in the wrong place because you've made a wrong choice or it's not for you, then nothing will ever gel, and you're fighting against yourself, regardless of surroundings.
I think that's a really pertinent point, because if you're living in an environment, even if it's a hostile or a difficult environment, if you've got a clear sense of self and what your needs are and whether they can be met, and how you deal with the situation. Some people will just break down, like the students you mentioned who were in tears after 3 days and want
to
go home. And a lot of people will cry after 3 days, but some will then be resolved afterwards and say, right, I'm sticking it. But some will go. I think going to university is a necessary, no, obviously there are other, it doesn't have to be university that does that, but stepping outside of your comfort zone helps you realise what your comfort zone is. And in my case, there was no going back. I couldn't go back. I mean, I'm very close to my parents and always have been. Once I left at the age of 18, the thought of returning into my old room, I felt that I'd really moved on. So a lot of my friends...
I wasn't allowed to. When I left home at 20... Shame, what would the neighbours think? So I was never allowed to go back, so I had to keep moving on.
What was the fear, what was the shame element that you...
Oh, that I left home.
Yeah.
You left home only if you were going to university or the army or training to be a nurse, none of which applied to me. I left home because I didn't like commuting to work, and I didn't like being home at 10 o'clock at night when I was at a concert at the Albert Hall. But my father never forgave me. Yeah. Such were those times.
What about political influences when you were there? Because, I mean, I voted, the first election I voted in was in 92, and I was, I mean, it was very exciting because we were in a very marginal seat, which was won by Clyde Cymru. Mm. And then it had been a Lib Dem seat. But it always seemed to buck the trend that the Ceredigion seat never went the same way as what was happening nationally. So it felt like a little oasis. But you were there during some of those years. Was, were you sort of heavily involved or aware of other students who were politically active?
Yeah, one in particular, Paul Baptie. he was the Green Party, and he was going to be Prime Minister of Britain with the Green Party. Bless him, he married a lovely girl, and he's in Czechoslovakia now. He was a graduate. He graduated a year after me. But he was convinced that the Green Party was the only way to go, and that Plaid Cymru might be very Welsh, but for the whole world it was the Green Party, and so on. I was not politically involved in Wales, although I was prior to Wales, and I was also a candidate when I moved to Somerset later. But I've crossed the political floor, and now I don't trust any of them.
No, no, and I do remember, though, that back in 92, I had two friends, one of whom is now the leader of the Cornish National Party, the other, who I can't claim to know so well, he was the president of the Students' Union in my first year, and he was, up until 2017, a Conservative MP.
Right.
So, and again, it always seemed to me that the Student Union was very left-wing, and it felt that, certainly at the time, this was the early days of the John Major government, and you know, the Conservatives were not hugely popular after, after Margaret Thatcher. And so I just at the time there was this assumption, maybe naively really, the students were very left-wing. Nationalism was quite large. There were plenty of Clive Cymru supporters, and not just among the Welsh students. There were many who felt that this was an important cause, even if they were not able to vote.
I sometimes wonder why students do latch on to any particular party. I know that when I was growing up, my father was Labour and my mother was Tory, and I was always told by each in turn why I should affiliate to one or the other. But then political parties change in their aims and they change in their ethics and everything else. And having been away from UK now for about 20 years, I don't get too emotionally involved, especially with things like Brexit.
Yes, and it's worth saying as well, because obviously this interview will go out a bit later, but we were supposed to leave the European Union on the 31st of October, which was 2 days ago.
I am thrilled that it's not happening, because I'm going to Australia for Christmas. I'm flying out of Larnaca, which is in the south, and I live in the north of Cyprus, and we're all quite sure that there would be problems with Brexit because we're no longer in the EU. But Cyprus will continue to be in the EU, and just sometimes there can be friction from north to south. So I am thrilled that I'm going to be able to go to Larnaca and go to Australia without any headaches. But I mean, will Brexit ever happen?
No. Well, I was interviewing the nephew of Shirley Williams a few weeks ago.
Oh, really? Yes, I remember her well.
Yeah, and he was saying that, having spoken to her on this question, probably, you know, we've just got on like this forever. Nothing's ever going to happen. But what I thought was intriguing about Brexit is that we were told we were definitely going to leave on the 31st, and I thought, well, I'm due to go to a conference in Belgium in December. And I thought, well, therefore my passport will, it's due to expire in May, I'll have less than 6 months on my passport, so I need to get my passport changed.
Yeah.
So I did all that, and it came through at the start of the week. We got the passport in the post, and on that day we learned that it's going to be a general election on the very day that I'm giving a paper in Belgium. On the apocalypse.
Oh, wow.
I can't escape this. So somehow Brexit and elections, we had two elections since the one, you know, we're supposed to have fixed term parliaments, we've had two elections within the period that, you know, from the last, from the 2015 election to what should have been May 2020. So it's these are very tumultuous times. But have you, I mean, obviously the 80s as well, the miner strike. But
yes, that's what
was the sort of the current, what were the currents in West Wales at the time? I mean, what were people, were people marching? Were students up in arms about particular causes? Nuclear disarmament, for example?
Yeah, I can't remember, but I do know that in my heart I was a supporter of Plaid Cymru, and I was in my heart a supporter of Wales becoming independent, because I know that I lived in the middle of a farming area and it was two fingers in the air to Westminster from all the Welsh farmers. You know, they had no respect, and I can understand why. But I remember that, oh, I was very fortunate. The first year that I started at uni, I went in for the new entrance exam because I was terrified of having to do essays after years of not doing it. And I won the scholarship. And the following year, I had another go. And one of the essays that we did was, Could Wales Be Independent? And I had to decide, as many of us did, that it would be an economic disaster. So much as many of the Welsh people wanted to be independent. And going back to the miners' strike, I hate strikes. I can see why people do it, because they're absolutely desperate. But then it creates more desperate people, children without food on the table, wives pulling their hair out. And it affects them psychologically as well as financially, physically and everything else. And I do not understand why human beings aren't capable of sitting down and sorting out problems with words, not strikes, not wars.
Yeah, and I, in my own profession sometimes, I feel very compromised that there might be a dispute about pensions or pay, but the students become the casualties, and the beef isn't with them. And I do feel that the issue is disruption, but of course, not all staff teach students anyway, so it's a question of proportion, really.
And I know people who have been very ardent union. My second husband was, and I could never understand it. But my brother, who worked for Lambeth Borough Council, had to be part of the union, and he got blacklisted because he said, I'm not going on strike. Don't believe in strike. But you're meant to do what the union says. I think that one as an adult should be allowed more choices.
Yeah, it feels twin pressures. You have the employer and the union, and they're both offering very competing and divergent claims.
Absolutely.
And some people will know instinctively which one to follow, and other people will just feel that they don't want to antagonise one side or the other.
I mean, it's shades of sort of Hitler. I often felt sorry for the German population who got swayed by Hitler's rhetoric, and we're all capable of doing just that. And I feel sometimes the unions use that same kind of tactic to fire people up to do things which in normal circumstances they would say are irrational and not for them.
But on a lighter note, when I was certainly at university, I used to listen to the radio an awful lot, and I still do, but I don't know if I'm a minority in that sense, but maybe it's more of a generational thing.
Probably, I just listen to music.
Were you a big radio listener when you were at university?
No, because I was at university sort of busy all day, and I went home very rarely. My home was my car the day, and I used to have my dog with me, and I didn't even have television. I didn't discover when I bought my lovely old Welsh farmhouse that it was amongst 2% of the population of the British Isles that couldn't get television reception. So I didn't see television either, so I lived in this bubble almost of university.
And a few more philosophically based questions to round off. Would you say, Marion, as you survey the whole of your life, although you might want to focus on particular areas, your memories are predominantly positive?
I have made them positive. There are many memories that, in essence, were negative. But I'm my spirituality has changed from the old Victorian Christian path that if you didn't obey all the rules, you fell off. And since I've been able to travel and see much of the world, it very much changes things like understanding of religion, racism, and many other things. And combined with going to university and just looking at spirituality academically, I now embrace far more a sort of humanist stance of we're part of the universe, everything is connected, and that the more you give thanks, the better you become and the happier you become. So I like to turn around all those negative things and sort of say, well, thank you for that, because I have learned this lesson, or I have tried to improve in that area through the negatives of, yeah, the bullying and the fun making and a divorce and some tough emotional experiences.
I mean, I guess these experiences can sometimes lead to more positive outcomes. In themselves, they're horrible.
Yeah, or you have a breakdown.
But absolutely, can you be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Yes, I think I can, because I've had some really, really dark moments. Depression is something that runs through my family, and I can get very depressed. I now understand myself, but earlier on they really were very dark, dark places, which at the time I didn't understand. But looking back, yes, I can get nostalgic, because if there is some great master plan and all these nasty bits, school of life type thing, then yes, I can get nostalgic. And anyway, they're my history, they're not my present, they're not my reality now.
Well, and often they're yardsticks, so you can sort of say, been there, done that, and
absolutely,
I'm not tracing down that path again.
What's new, what's coming that's new?
Well, that's exciting.
That I can use those experiences and bring into the now to make the now better. It's like when I do funerals, because I have lost people I love, and because I was trained in church and have an understanding, I have an empathy to people that I wouldn't have unless I'd had those bad experiences. So that applies to lots of aspects of our lives. If you turn those negatives into positives, it gives you empathy, which is a very, very important thing when dealing with people.
And do you want to say something about the work you do with funerals? Because you always seem to be, often many a week, you're officiating at weddings.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Only in Cyprus. It's a very funny system in Cyprus anyway. The legal side takes 2 minutes. So if anybody wants a wedding ceremony, you can forget about being shoved up by a filing cabinet in the government office and just say, yeah, I do, yeah, thanks, sign. So someone asked if I would do a ceremony because I had been connected with the church. And it's like Topsy, it's just brewed. And I find it's a great privilege, because I get to know people. Some of the people have become friends. And I personalise it. I learn about the people and share, a bit like the after-dinner speeches during the ceremony. Because people matter, and these big moments in their lives matter. And if I'm contributing to that moment, then I must make it the best it can possibly be for their memories, for the future, for their nostalgia.
And do you keep in touch with those couples?
Yeah, a lot. Yeah. Well, in fact, one of the couples from Wales, Nikki and Andy, they house it for me. They come over and house it, and I go off on my jaunt, leaving my fur babies behind. And the funerals, I train to do funerals in the church. But more and more people these days don't do religion, but they need to have that door-closing experience of saying goodbye to their loved ones. And so I do this humanist-type ceremony, although I will do prayers if people want, because I'm quite good at them.
What do you think, though, doing all of these things now, what would your, say, 15-year-old self make of what you're doing?
Oh, good gracious, who's she? Yeah. I have no idea at all. None of us can project into the future. I mean, I was meant to be a world-famous opera singer. Now I do funerals. I thought I was called... One thing I must share, and it sounds very twee, and I don't really do twee, but when I was a pastor assistant in Cuddam, I was in church one day, I can't remember what, but on my own, and a voice, a very loud voice, said, "Feed my sheep," looking over my shoulder, who the heck is that? And I felt I was called to the priesthood, and that's why I carried on pursuing it through all the negatives. Oh, of course, I was a divorcee, that went against me, and I was a woman, and that went against me, whatever. But you see, now I am feeding the sheep that are not of that pasture. And again, I couldn't possibly have understood that 40 years ago I heard that voice.
And do you think then that you had dreams when you were young? And you mentioned being an opera star, but would you say that you fulfilled, you may not have fulfilled that particular dream, but you know that whole sort of notion of wondering sometimes whether you still entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life?
Yeah, I do, but at my age there aren't that many doors. I mean, hallelujah for North Cyprus, it's not like here. I could come back and do weddings here as a self-employed, I suppose. Maybe I'm going to get discovered one day.
Do you think you might move back to the UK, or do you think you'll stay in Cyprus?
I can't afford it. I was looking, there's lots of charity jobs going that I'd love to do, because I worked for Mind when I was in Wales, up at Aberystwyth. I've worked for Save the Children Fund in the park. But by the time I get that salary and I pay tax on all of it because I get a pension, it will all go in rent.
And you moved to Cyprus. Was that, how did that come about in the first place? Was
it, I don't know.
Just one of those
I was
journeys.
Living in Australia. Yeah. And I eventually sold my house in Wales, so we bought a little flat in North Cyprus so that Alan could go somewhere that was European. And we did that for 3 years commuting, and each year he had a deep vein thrombosis, the first two being dealt with in Australia, but the third one was in North Cyprus. And he was told he really couldn't travel anymore. Get him back to Australia, but then he couldn't go anywhere. And Alan was very European, because I was also very involved in the church in Australia, and the Uniting Church were looking at ordaining me. But that didn't happen, because I let Alan decide where he wanted to be, and he preferred to be nearer to Europe. So, dutiful wife, he stayed in Cyprus, and all these doors have opened up since. Well, sadly, Alan's now buried in the cemetery, where at least I go up and say hi every time I do a funeral. So, well, the future, I don't know. If I win the lottery, there's all kinds of things I might do, but without the money, North Cyprus is the cheapest place in the Mediterranean, and it's half the price of everything here. And I'm sort of part of the furniture now.
And, well, the next question, which is the last but one, is a stupid question to ask, because it's whether you are still in touch with friends of your past. But in your case, I don't know anybody as prolific as you are in maintaining these connections. I'll ask this question to some people who say, oh, I don't do social media, or, you know, there's one friend from school I keep in touch
loss,
with once
it?
Every decade. But in your case, this is sort of...
Yeah,
hundreds.
I mean, it's amazing. I've got 2,000 friends on Facebook, and people make fun. I said, well, they're not really friends, they're contacts, and I'm thrilled to have them. People from my past have found me via Facebook, and I have found people I'd lost in touch with, again, through social media. And it's, people don't talk to each other much these days, or everybody's all over the world. I mean, I'm here today with you, and I'm off to Scotland, and then I'm back to Cyprus, and I'm off to Australia, where I've got friends. So without social media, how could I keep in touch? I grew up in a home that didn't even have a telephone. So yeah, people are important, as I say, we are all linked, and it keeps me not believing the age that I am. Thank you.
Well, I agree with everything that you've said. I'm not going to comment on your age, so I was referring to what you said before that.
I am accessible. I say I'm somewhere between 21 and death, darling.
So somewhere, you're approaching middle age.
That would do nicely.
But I do feel though that in terms of reconnecting, because before I used social media, I was desperate to reclaim some of those friendships. It was because they felt like unfinished business.
Yeah,
it felt
absolutely.
That there were friendships where
there were a chapter that never got finished.
Yeah, absolutely. Because yes, they may have ended on graduation day, but it felt that the story wasn't resolved. We knew lots about our 18 and 19 year old selves, but when we hit 30 and then 40, I was thinking, well, I need to go back to some of those people to say, well, you knew the answers then.
Yeah, and who are you now? Where are you now? And again, I mean, as you're kind of doing, well, did Lampeter change you? did you make friends there? Did it change your thinking? You know, and it's nice to find out sort of 20 years later what everybody else feels.
For me, it was the day I started growing up and living, because I had a wonderful childhood, but I didn't really make all that many choices of my own. They were made for me.
Of course not. Your parents, that's your parents' role.
And suddenly at university, as I say, for the first week, it was, gosh, what have I done? What am I doing here?
But then the one good thing about university is you still got a support group. You're not out there in the wilderness like in exile.
No, it wasn't. And I think that now those support groups could be found on social media.
Absolutely.
But then we were very much cultivating friendships through different societies, or of course in lectures, and what happened after lectures, when we'd all go to Pooh's Corner and have a coffee.
Yep.
And
then the contest was the other one I was always in.
And they're the things that I remember most.
I'm still in touch with Jo Conte, who was Mr. Conte's daughter. And she was friends with my daughter. So, all the 30 years later, there's still the contact.
It all comes around. But my very last question, which I think you've answered, but it's whether you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Oh, you've got to look forward. I don't know how long I've got. One day, 30 years. Will I make the Guinness Book of Records for longevity? Will I continue with good health? All the while I've got good health, I want to use my life. And that's one of the reasons why, if I came back here, I think it would be Elephant's Graveyard, because I don't know what opportunities. But life is a gift, and if you don't use it, you're slapping that gift round the face and insulting the giver of that gift, whoever you understand it to be. In my case, some divine being. But I'm looking forward. Please, inshallah, as they say, where I live. Yes.
And on that bombshell in a pub, which is a little less noisy than when we started the interview.
I wonder why they've all left, Chris. Do you think it's because of us?
But what a wonderful treat to catch up with you, Marion.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Chris, my pleasure.